From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today, we'll break down the report card for Wisconsin's infrastructure, from wastewater to telecommunications. Then we'll learn how actor Henry Winkler navigated his dyslexia while portraying the Fonz on Happy Days.
If you want something, there is always a way to figure out how to do it. I just had to work harder. That's all. I just had to read it over and over and over again.
Plus, we'll learn about the Black Cross nurses and the work they've done.
They saw it as being part of the Marcus Garvey movement, number one, and number two, helping to solve the problems of our people, and that being health issues.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. The American Society of Civil Engineers, or ASCE, is America's oldest national engineering society, and the Wisconsin section has been part of it since 1923. Part of the organization's work is releasing report cards for state infrastructure. This year, Wisconsin's infrastructure received an overall score of a C+. While this is a slight improvement from our 2020 score, 9 categories scored are in mediocre condition, and 3 are in poor condition. To break down the report, Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski speaks with Zoe Myers, one of the co-chairs of the ASCE report card.
So the American Society of Civil Engineers released a report card for Wisconsin's infrastructure, and we got an overall grade of a C+. But before we get into some of the specifics of this report, can you share in general what the criteria for grading are that you and other engineers compiled for this?
Of course. So we have what we call the 8 key criteria. So those would be capacity, condition, funding, future need, operation and maintenance, public safety, resilience, and innovation. So those 8 things all have different weights and kind of all encompass how we grade each individual chapter. And then at the end of the day, how those individual chapter grades become our overarching grade.
And what categories are new in this engineering report for the first time?
So new to Wisconsin are public parks, rail, schools, which that grade was an incomplete. We need some more data on it. And then brand new to the society-wide, so Wisconsin was the first ever broadband chapter.
So why and how do you pick and realize the potential for new categories?
So infrastructure is the backbone of society, and as society is changing and growing, we need new measures for how things are functioning. So broadband, for instance, is becoming very important these days, as now we're transitioning away from in-person and doing these virtual sessions. Broadband is needed, so that's how we added that chapter. So as things in society come up, we want to make sure that we can get an accurate grade of how Wisconsin is doing, so we add those new chapters as we see fit.
Definitely. And how much did the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act impact this year's report card? I understand, you know, our grade is overall an improvement from 2020, but is that thanks in part to this, or were there other things that were progressing in the works already?
Yeah, so the Infrastructure Investment Jobs Act is a small part. So that is going to be, you're going to be seeing funding allocated for that through 2021 through 2026. And right now, the funding is allocated, so a lot of those projects we haven't seen come through the works yet. So we're expecting that act show a little bit more, but there was other things in place, like other procedures and other investments we're going through before that Jobs Act that we're seeing, and that's why we're seeing this increase.
Gotcha. So when you are taking such a big picture look at Wisconsin's infrastructure, what kind of new challenges did civil engineers have to contend with to take into account?
So a lot of challenges that we tend to see are backlogs of work that just we don't have the funding for, that we just keep seeing growing larger and larger. And then a big thing we're starting to notice is our weather events. So as engineers, we design to certain standards based on severe weather events with a 100-year, 200-year, 50-year outlook, and we're seeing those more and more frequently. So the talk now is, do those standards need to change so that way we design differently? Because when you have 5 200-year rain events or 500-year rain events in the span of a couple of years, that's more frequent than what we're designing for. So infrastructure needs to meet those new standards and for what we're seeing in today's world.
And in general, are engineers on the same page about the impact of climate change? I know sometimes politicians, policymakers have varying viewpoints, which can impact the resources a lot of people get. But as engineers, is there a consensus?
I say that a lot of us are in agreement that things are, like, standards are changing and we're going to need to do something. What that something is or what that's going to look like for the future, we're still spitballing and trying to find ideas, but in general, something needs to change so that way our infrastructure can be sustainable for the future.
All right, so let's break down a few select categories in this report, starting with public parks, which got a D score. So what are some of the main factors public parks are struggling with that resulted in this score?
So Wisconsin is one of the few states in the nation that most of our public parks are funded by exclusively user fees, and that has remained stagnant while costs of maintenance and our infrastructure is getting older. So it's just those fees are no longer able to keep up with the aging infrastructure and then the amount of people coming into our parks. Actually, Wisconsin is ranked 17th in participation for people coming into our national parks, or state parks rather. But we're actually 49th in the average money spent per resident and 50th in money spent per visit on those parks. So even though we're seeing some funding increasing, those funds can't go to our state parks without approval directly from the legislator, and they just don't have that right now. So while we might see some fees going up on the user end, those parks are yet to be seeing that money. So that's playing a large part into why their grade isn't as high as maybe it could be.
And next up, we'll tackle solid waste, which got a B, which is a handful of categories with this score. There's a number of Bs, which is good. But I understand that Wisconsinites recycle more than the national average, which was kind of a surprising fact for me to learn.
Correct. So our solid waste grade actually went up from a B minus in 2020 up to a B. And that's because we're meeting the current demands with all of our landfills. And correct, Wisconsin, actually, we do recycle more than the average American, and we produce less waste than the average American. So those two coupled together pay really well for us to have a better grade in this category. We also have lots of state regulations put in place to ensure that all of our landfills are protected environmentally, and there's procedures placed in so that way even after they close, there's no negative environmental effects on any of the residents or any of our water, anything surrounding that area, which is really nice.
Talking about water, let's talk about wastewater specifically. We got a D plus, and I think this category is an example of where the urban-rural divide is pretty evident, you know, because like cities like Milwaukee, we might have a good infrastructure. We're familiar with MMSD and similar facilities like that. But smaller facilities in other less populated areas really lack the resources to improve, right?
You would be correct. So unfortunately, wastewater was one of our few categories that decreased in grade from 2020 to now. So we started a C minus in 2020 and now we're at a D plus. And unfortunately, this is due to the aging infrastructure. There's also new controls placed on discharge. So they have to meet certain standards that some infrastructure, like you mentioned before, and some of those smaller municipalities and communities don't have the funding to support just yet. As well as there's also becoming a surplus need. As our population continues to grow, so does our need for that wastewater. So the infrastructure we put in place 20, 30 years ago is no longer able to handle the amount of people that we have. So we actually have an estimated need for $5.5 billion in infrastructure just for our wastewater needed over the next 20 years. And we're not seeing all of that funding just yet. So that's one area that Wisconsin really needs to grow in.
So overall, we have improved in these 17 categories since last evaluation in 2020, with a few exceptions like wastewater and a couple others. But when you are looking at this big picture, what are one or two potential solutions you see to some of our most pressing infrastructure needs? And that can be like in general as a state, or if we can, you know, use any specific category as an example, if you like.
Yeah, so I'll kind of do one of each, I guess. So
sure.
Big picture. One thing Wisconsin needs to continue to do, so yes, we've increased, we did a good job. However, the job's not done yet. At the end of the day, the grade's still a C+, and when you're grading at an A to F scale, that's just above average. So one big thing, even just the everyday American can do is just increase awareness of it. So a lot of the times you don't think of your infrastructures, your solid waste, your wastewater, you don't think about those on a day-to-day basis until it becomes a problem, and then it's a larger problem. So if we can just think about these things more before it becomes a problem and get ahead of it, and just push our legislators and our government to try to allocate more funding towards our infrastructure, we'd be much better off. And to just kind of dial in on a smaller picture. So for instance, we touched on public parks a little bit, and I mentioned that fees are increasing for the users. However, there's not any more money going to those public parks. Well, if we talk to the, like, reach out again to the legislators, they make the budgets, they do that stuff. So we just push for what we want and make a louder voice for these infrastructure, specifically these public parks here. They'll be able to know that that's what we want and budget more accordingly to what we want as Wisconsin residents.
Well, Zoe, I want to thank you so much for joining me today to break down some of this report card.
Thank you so much for having me.
Zoe Myers is an engineer at JT Engineering and one of the co-chairs of the ASCE report card. She spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski, and you can find a link to the full report card at WUWM.com.
This is Capital Notes from Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Ayan Silver. We're 2 weeks from the November general election. It's time to check in with J.R. Ross, editor of WizPolitics.com. Welcome, J.R. Thanks for being here.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right, let's start with the top of the ticket, the presidential race in Wisconsin. What right now are the voting blocks that you see the GOP and the Trump campaign trying to mobilize in Wisconsin these last few weeks ahead of the election, and what are the coalitions you're seeing the Harris campaign concentrating on?
Well, they're going to their bases, and they're going to try to pick up some votes in the margin. So, you know, J.D. Vance in Waukesha, for example, on Sunday, Kamala Harris in Milwaukee, La Crosse in Green Bay. You know, J.D.'s hitting those suburbs. They need to not necessarily win, you know, a big number in Waukesha County, but at least win it and win it by the right margin. Get above 60%, that would help a great deal. You know, Kamala Harris going to Milwaukee, Green Bay college campuses, they're trying to excite those folks. Remember, in 2020, in a razor-thin presidential election, college kids weren't on campus back then. They were at home on Madison, for example, where a good chunk of the population is from out of state. Those guys were back where they live, for the high school. So you're talking a population you can maybe drive the polls this time and help with your numbers. They're basically trying to find ways to get their base going, which is why you saw Trump in places like, you know, Wausau and Juneau, like deep red areas, but also kind of the margins, which is why Trump went to Dane County, trying not to win Dane County, but not lose it by as badly as he did 4 years ago. Likewise, you're going to see Harris and Tim Walz going around places trying to get their base jazzed up, maybe cutting some margins up places. Oh, and then by the way, early voting starts on the 22nd. Barack Obama coming to Madison. I think if they could, they'd have like buses waiting to take college kids from where they're going to be right to the nearest early voting site. They're trying to like harness that early vote and get people excited and to turn out. Because right now, we're in kind of a jump ball election in Wisconsin. That's what it feels like when talking to people. And that means the turnout operation really becomes key. And Democrats feel like they've got a better turnout operation because it's been battle-tested in Wisconsin, cycle in, cycle out, than Republicans do.
You mentioned Barack Obama coming on Tuesday, which is tomorrow, to Dane County. And, you know, there's been a lot of reporting about some polling showing slippage for Harris among voters of color, specifically Black and Latino men. Others point out that voters of color are a reliable voting bloc for Democrats and almost certainly will be again this year. How do you see this playing out in places like Milwaukee and Madison ahead of that visit and the first day of early voting?
Yeah, it's a great question about Milwaukee. It's an interesting place because if you go back and look at turnout in 16 and 20, 16 was down compared to 12. 12 was obviously when Barack Obama was last on the ballot in Wisconsin. But even in 20, it wasn't really up dramatically. Even as the state, you know, as a whole, turnout improved significantly from 2020 versus 2016, Milwaukee wasn't up that much. And so the question is, how does a Harris, for example, connect with voters on Milwaukee's north side, gets black and brown voters excited for her candidacy. She is, you know, Barack Obama, obviously the nation's first black president. He had a certain kind of appeal, a pitch that generated enthusiasm in the black community. Does Harris do these, get the same enthusiasm? Don't forget, the economy has been tough on people across the spectrum in a lot of ways. Prices being up. There's lots of talk about how voters, not just those of color, but others who are kind of like looking for change because they want, you know, prices to go down. It's a challenge. But you need to hit certain marks. I mean, that's what they're looking for, is to try and generate enthusiasm, get their marks, and turn them out. So we'll see. You know, there's 2 weeks left. I can't give you a clear picture right now of what's going to happen in the presidential race because the people I talk to are waiting for something to break. It feels like this is a jump ball presidential election once again. And they're wondering, is something going to happen to move the electorate? I mean, there's only 2 weeks left. So what is that thing going to be if it happens? Does it break? You know, we've seen polls overall that show the momentum kind of moving toward Trump, that polls have tightened. Is that just Wisconsin being Wisconsin because we're always razor thin? Or does that mean there's real momentum for Trump? That's the big thing we're wondering. Like, what's going to push this race one direction or another in the final weeks that could take care of all these issues for either side?
There have been high-profile conservatives who have endorsed Harris both nationally and in Wisconsin. And in the latest Marquette Law School poll, 10% of people who identify as conservatives say they'll be voting for Harris versus 1% of people who identify as liberal who say they'll be voting for Trump. Have you ever seen this before?
No. Sorry to chuckle, but this is there are certain dynamics when it comes to Donald Trump that are just kind of fascinating to watch. There are Republicans who are not going to vote for Donald Trump. What are they going to do? Are they going to vote for RFK? Are they going to vote for Harris? Are they just going to skip the presidential race in general? I mean, that's a fascinating question. You see a lot of high-profile people on social media who are conservatives saying, you got to vote for Trump to save the Republican Party. I'm not sure that the average kind of like conservative voter in Wisconsin feels the same way, maybe. So it's a huge question, you know. And look, the other thing about Trump is his operation is interesting in that Turning Point USA is a group that's big fans of Donald Trump. They're trying to find low propensity Trump voters who maybe wouldn't turn out normally and get them to turn out for the election. Usually, you know, the parties look for people who are casual voters who aren't always going to turn out, but they're open to your message and trying to get the, they're doing a different tack. They're looking for where are we trying to find Trump people to turn them out. So if those conservatives who don't like Trump stay home, can Trump offset that with these groups like Turning Point getting these Trump fans who aren't usually voters to turn out? That's a gamble, but it might pay off for them. It's going to be interesting to watch. The exit polls will be fascinating off this election, like they often are, to see just what the coalition was like. Where are the inroads that Trump made with black and brown voters? Does Kamala Harris take Dane County to new heights in terms of the turnout and the percentage won? You know, Joe Biden got like 75% of the vote in 2020. Tony Evers got to 78%. Can it go higher? There's all kinds of fascinating, it's like basically a giant puzzle. Wisconsin's a massive puzzle, and you're trying to fit the pieces together for your operation to hit marks that lead to a victory.
You're tuned into Capitol Notes. I'm WEWM's Mayan Silver, speaking with J.R. Ross, editor of WizPolitics.com. So we're looking at very, very, very narrow margins, potentially down to 5,000 votes or something like that. When it comes to these third-party candidates that are on the ballot, Democrats are trying to call Green Party candidate Jill Stein as a spoiler candidate. RFK, the state Supreme Court says, is going to remain on the ballot. What are you hearing about the conversation around these third-party candidates and what impact that might have?
Oh, we're in basically the worry stage for both parties. They're worried about everything that they look at, you know. So with RFK, you know, are the people who in the polls say they still support him, even though he's out of the race, are they like true believers who are going to vote for RFK no matter what? Are they Republicans, because RFK was drawing more Republicans than Democrats, who are going, you know, I don't like Trump, I don't want to vote for him, so I'm going to vote for RFK. But when it push comes to shove with RFK endorsing Trump, will they pull the trigger for Trump on Election Day? Maybe. Jill Stein, you know, there wasn't a Green Party candidate on the ballot in 2020. Did that swing the election? Maybe. You know, in the rehash of 2016, some people want to scapegoat the Green Party and say that Jill Stein is the reason why Hillary Clinton lost Wisconsin. Well, maybe had an impact, but Hillary Clinton to come to Wisconsin after the spring primary in 2016, they weren't running heavy ads here. They didn't have the ground game that you'd normally expect. They took Wisconsin for granted. So in some ways, it takes the burden or the blame off of the campaign that Clinton ran by saying that Jill Stein's the reason why she lost. So Stein's the ballot this time. How many of those Greens who are going to vote for Jill Stein on Election Day 2024 didn't vote for anybody in 2020 because they are true Greens? They aren't casual folks, voters. They are party members, essentially, who believe in the cause, and it's either Green or nobody. That I don't know. But if we're 5,000 votes, 11,000 votes, sure, it can matter. But, you know, it's hard to tell because we're just, again, things feel so like kind of up in the air right now that at some point things might move. That might give us a clearer picture of what's going on out there with this presidential race.
Fair enough. Okay, so we've got a whole bunch of important down ballot races too. There's the U.S. Senate seat, but there's also a bunch of state legislative races in the Assembly and half of the Senate, state Senate. Can you remind me what your take is of, you know, there's new maps, what may be possible for Democrats to flip and what is not looking realistic?
You're not going to flip the state Senate this cycle if you're a Democrat. What you're hoping to do is win enough seats that in 2026, then you can flip the chamber. Because looking at it, they began this cycle with Republicans with 22 votes. There are five races people are kind of watching, one held by a Democrat. That one looks to lean in favor of Brad Path, the state senator, the Democrat in that office right now. Other four are GOP-held seats. So if you're a Democrat, you got to win three. That's the key. Win three of those four. Then there are three in the ballot in 2026. That if you sweep those, you're in the majority. If you win four of those four seats this fall, it makes 2026 way easier. But it's not going to be an easy task necessarily. There's a new 18th Senate district in the kind of Oshkosh to Appleton area along Lake Winnebago, not western shore of the lake. That's a pretty Democratic seat. It's open. Okay. There's one that if Democrats are going to have a good night, they should win that one fairly comfortably. I mean, not a blowout, but in decent numbers. Then you got to go up into Green Bay, where it's kind of a 50-50-ish seat, maybe a little slight Dem lean. Jamie Wall, a Democratic businessman who's run for Congress up there before, is running against Jim Rafter, a Republican, the Alouette's Village president. You need to win that if you're a Democrat. You get leaned your way a little bit. Now you get down to two interesting seats. One in the Milwaukee suburbs, Dewey Strobel. It's a Republican leaning seat. I mean, slight Republican lean. But this is a suburban seat where Democrats have kind of struggled in the era of Donald Trump. But Dewey Strobel is a pretty conservative guy. He's trying to paint himself as a moderate, interesting tack in that seat. He's running against Jody Havish-Sinikin, a Democratic attorney. And then over in the 14th Senate District, north of Madison, kind of in the Richland County area, north of the city, you have Joan Baldwin, Republican, running at Sarah Kayeski, nonprofit leader. So again, Democratic-leaning seat on the new maps, but you have an experienced Republican who's run before, raised money, running. So can Joan Baldwin fight against the tide of that district? Maybe. If it's a good night for Democrats, Kamala Harris wins Wisconsin by even a little bit, it should help Sarah Kayeski. If Trump wins Wisconsin, makes that seat be a little less Democratic. That would help Joan Baldwin. Over in the Assembly, the new maps, everything's up for grabs. The reality is Republicans will probably hold the Assembly unless they get good coattails from Kamala Harris and Tammy Baldwin. I'm talking like maybe a plus three, the top of the ticket thing. That opens an avenue to get to 50. But in true jump ball, top of the ticket election, those maps still favor Republicans a little bit. And I stress a little bit. There's a path, but you know, you can see Republicans landing anywhere from 48 to 54-ish seats. Just depends on how good the night goes. For Democrats, you know, anywhere 46 to, they could get the majority. And I say it that way because tell me how the topic is going to go. That'll help me a whole lot in telling you what a good number is to guess for either side after the election dust settles.
So interesting. All right. Well, thanks for that rundown, JR. As a reminder, people can get information on many of these legislative races at wuwm.com/voterguide. And you can look up what's on your ballot at myvote.wi.gov. Thanks for filling us in, JR. And thanks for joining me on Capitol Notes.
Anytime.
Just like Capitol Notes, Lake Effect can also be found as a podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. In about 15 minutes, we'll learn about the Black Cross nurses. But first, we'll be joined by the bronze fawns in the flesh, Henry Winkler. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. If you're walking along the river in downtown Milwaukee, you may see a familiar face cast in bronze. The character affectionately known as the Fonz from the TV show Happy Days. During the show's decade-long tenure, the Fonz became one of the most beloved characters on television, as well as the man who portrayed him, Henry Winkler. In the time since Happy Days first premiered, Winkler has gone on to have an illustrious career, starring in television shows, films, and becoming a prolific author, despite his own struggle with dyslexia. Winkler will be in Milwaukee to talk about one of his latest books, Being Henry, The Fonz and Beyond. The event will take place this Wednesday at the Oriental Theater. But ahead of that, he joined me by phone to talk about his work. Henry, thank you so much for being here on Lake Effect.
Thank you.
We have actually met once before. I interviewed you a little more than a decade ago when I was doing my undergrad at Emerson College, of which you are also an alum. Yeah.
Was I polite?
You were very polite. I remember you went around the room. You shook everyone's hand.
Wonderful.
It was very sweet. You showed me and my friend at the time a bunch of photos of fly fishing.
Oh, yes, of course. I always have to show my fish.
Yeah, I believe you were putting together your book on fly fishing at the time.
Yeah, oh, Lord. That was a while.
Yeah, this was a while ago. Wow. But actually, with that in mind, you recently published a book about your life, Being Henry, The Fonz and Beyond. Yeah.
Can I brag?
Yeah, you can brag, of course.
It was on the New York Times bestseller list for 11 weeks in a row.
I mean, you're really a cultural icon. That does not surprise me.
Well, it surprised me. It really did. I mean, holy mackerel. Remember, I grew up not being able to read, and here I am writing. This is our 39th children's book.
Wow. You have written so much. I do actually have questions for you in just a moment about your experience with dyslexia. But, you know, of course, as somebody from Milwaukee, I have to ask you about the bronze Fonz. You are one of a relatively small number of people who have a statue of their likeness in the city, and maybe the only one that's smack dab in the middle of Milwaukee. What is that like, seeing yourself in bronze?
You know, I have to tell you that I still pinch myself. That is not something you get over. It's pretty amazing that I should have a statue anywhere, let alone my adopted second home.
It is a little wild. Happy Days really has a place in the heart, I think, of many Wisconsinites because it was set here. Of course, your character, Arthur Fonzarelli, was kind of meant to be a sort of side character, but you really became the breakout star. Can you take us back to when the show first began? What was that like for you?
Well, I had six lines. I worked one day a week.
Yeah.
I was in 7 out of the 13 first episodes. So I was so duty-bound, I could not go and play on weekdays when on a work day. So I would sit in my apartment and I would wait until I got the call of when to go to the studio. it's hard work to make a comedy. So we work together as a team. We are still a team. I'm going to see, I saw Ron at the Emmys, and I'm going to see Don and Anson in a Comic-Con in Tennessee in a week and a half.
Wow. I mean, what was it like working with someone like Ron Howard, even at that stage, who had already become kind of a commodity through the through his work on the Andy Griffith Show?
Well, I will tell you that we had a chemistry that you cannot fabricate. It's either there or it's not. And when we did the Emmys 50 years later, just a few weeks ago, as we stood in that set of Arnold's, it was like a thunderbolt. The chemistry came back immediately for the 45-second skit we had.
With that in mind in the show and all of the many things that go around creating a show of this kind, one of the things you've been very open about is your experience with dyslexia and, of course, being diagnosed much later in life. Was that a struggle for you when you started doing TV? It's a bit different than doing a stage show where you have one script, you have one show. You're getting new scripts all the time for TV.
Well, remember also, like, you get a white script on Monday, then you get a blue, a green, a pink, a gold, a golden rod, and you constantly are memorizing and re-memorizing over the week as they rewrite the jokes. And not being able to read was a major chore. Also, everything depends on timing. And so I would screw up the other actor's timing because I gave them a wrong cue, my cue was late, you know, like that.
I mean, that's a lot to overcome. How did you negotiate that?
That is the word. You learn to negotiate it. And then what I did was I used humor to cover my embarrassment for not reading the right words. You know, if you want something, there is always a way to figure out how to do it. I just had to work harder. That's all. I just had to read it over and over and over again. And if I couldn't read, I did have the ability to memorize. So that was a saving grace.
Did you feel like the further you got into the show and the rhythm of making a show like this, that it got easier or it just got different?
No. Well, what was easier was the memorization. Because when you're really, it's like working a muscle. So if you do many episodes in a row, which we did, now they do like three and take a break. But if you do eight in a row, then all of a sudden it's like you can rub the script on your head and it goes in.
Sure. Now, this is a show that is theoretically set in Wisconsin, although its relationship to Wisconsin culture is hit and miss. There are moments of very Wisconsin, others that seem just overall Americana. As you were preparing to do the show, did you learn much about the state?
Well, we learned about the state because we visited it many times. We were treated with enormous warmth every time from 50 years ago until the last time I was there, until when I get there. I have been treated with enormous warmth.
The Fonz is a very beloved character here. Do you still see people who, first and foremost, they see you and go, oh my God, it's the Fonz?
Well, it all depends on the age of the person. Younger people know me from Arrested Development or Scream or The Waterboy or now Barry, you know? So it all depends, really, you know, kind of what generation the person is by recognizing me by one of the characters. But the Fonz, I am recognized worldwide. Still, 50 years later, with unbelievable affection.
Now, Kind of with that in mind, there is a concept I'm curious about. It's commonly talked about now in reference to television shows that have kind of gone downhill. And it actually stems from Happy Days and something your character did. I'm sure you know where I'm going with this, the idea of jumping the shark, which people say now.
Yes. But remember this.
Yeah.
Jumping the shark, when we jumped the shark, it became part of the vernacular, but we stayed number one for the next 4 or 5 years. So it really did not in any way damage or tarnish the reputation of the show or the popularity or the affection. It just became part of everyday conversation. Now, the first show I ever produced was MacGyver, which became part of the vernacular. Hey, you MacGyvered that.
That's interesting because these are both terms. I think people use the term jumping the shark having no idea where it stems from.
That's right. Well, especially now, that is true.
How do you feel about the term, especially as someone who, as you've...
Oh, you know what? It is only a phrase. It never affected us. I don't care. You know, it's lovely that people still use it, you know, and when it happened, when it first came, remember this, there were newspapers. People actually read newspapers. So every time they would mention Jump the Shark, they showed a picture of me water skiing, and I had really great legs at that time, so I didn't care at all.
I mean, you look great when you're jumping that shark.
Thank you so much.
So you're going to be here in Milwaukee discussing your books. You have Detective Duck, which you are currently touring with, but also Being Henry is coming out in paperback. What do you hope people learn about you and maybe learn about the industry as they read this book?
Well, you know what? My son, Max, our youngest, said, you know, Dad, you've got so many stories. You've got to write them. People will want to read them. And I said, well, I don't know how to do that. I know how to write children's books. I'm not sure I know how to write an adult book. And then, you know, where there's a will, there is a way.
Well, Henry, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect. We are very much looking forward to having you here in Milwaukee.
Thank you. Sunday, Monday, happy days. Tuesday, Wednesday, happy days. Thursday, Friday, happy days. The weekend comes, my cycle hums, ready to race to you.
Henry Winkler is an actor and producer, best known for his portrayal of the Fonz on Happy Days and his work on Arrested Development, Barry, and The Waterboy. He is currently touring with two of his latest books, Detective Duck and Being Henry. Winkler will be at the Oriental Theater this Wednesday at 7 o'clock to talk about his work. A new season of Bubbler Talk is on the way, and we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. Coming up next, we'll visit an exhibit that tells the story of the Black Cross nurses. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Sunday, Monday, happy days. Tuesday, Wednesday, happy days. Thursday, Friday. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. In the 1920s, amid an international pandemic, rising rates of tuberculosis and smallpox, and racial disparities in health outcomes, the Black Cross nurses were founded. The nurses trained Black people to become traveling nurses that met the needs of Black residents across the Western Hemisphere that were largely ignored by establishment public health institutions. An exhibit at the Wisconsin Black Historical Society chronicled the foundation of the Black Cross nurses in Milwaukee. Lake Effect Sam Woods went there to learn about the nurses and meet with modern healthcare workers who see themselves in the exhibit.
Vanessa Johnson was born 2 months early, at just over 2 pounds. Her mother was visiting Milwaukee during the 4th of July when she went into labor, while everyone around her dismissed her concerns.
And so, as you can suspect, she's coming here to just enjoy the holiday, and she went into labor. And no one believed her. They didn't think she was in labor. They told my father that he can go back to Indiana because my mother's just constipated. And so she was left to be alone in a hospital room laboring for hours at a time. And it wasn't until about 8 hours or so later that the doctor finally came in the room to check on her, and they could see me. I was coming out. And so it was, they were frantic and like, oh my goodness. And I was born.
Today, Vanessa is a reproductive health lactation nurse, doula birth worker, and yoga instructor with an emphasis on prenatal and postpartum health. She says that she chose this work due to her birth story and how her mother was largely left alone and ignored while Vanessa was born.
And so in an unfamiliar place, ill-prepared, not being listened to. And as a Black woman, you know, birthing in the 70s, the idea of not being listened to, your voice not being heard, is still continuing to this day. And so I really felt like somehow, some way, if I could provide a sense of peace in that moment for other families, then like, job well done.
But when I met Vanessa, she was fighting back tears of joy. As we were both learning about Milwaukee's long history of Black healthcare workers volunteering to provide medical care for Black residents and combat racial disparities in health outcomes over 100 years ago. We were at the Wisconsin Black Historical Society Museum's exhibit, Do for Self, the story of Milwaukee's Black Cross Nurses. The exhibit chronicles the foundation and story of the Milwaukee chapter of the Black Cross Nurses, which was a group of Black nurses dedicated to providing public health services to Black people, with chapters in Milwaukee, as well as places as far away as Nova Scotia and Panama. But before we get into the Milwaukee chapter of the Black Cross Nurses and Vanessa's connection to them, we need to establish some context, starting a little over 100 years ago with Marcus Garvey and the UNIA.
Fellow citizens of Africa, I greet you in the name of the Universal Negro Improvement Association and African Communities League of the World. You may ask, what organization is that? It is for me to inform you that the Universal Negro Improvement Association is an organization that seeks to unite into one solid body the 400 million Negroes of the world.
That's Marcus Garvey, speaking in 1921 about the goals of a new organization he had founded, the Universal Negro Improvement Association, or UNIA. Starting in Garvey's home country of Jamaica, the long-term goals of the UNIA centered on political and economic autonomy for the Black diaspora and encouraged a self-reliant Black nationalism. This is where the exhibit's Do for Self title comes from. Now, at the same time that the UNIA was getting going and Marcus Garvey was recording this speech in the early 1920s, the need for adequate public health services was impossible to ignore.
Every year in America, there are more than 100,000 new cases of tuberculosis. Of all infectious diseases, tuberculosis is still the greatest killer.
Tuberculosis, measles, and smallpox remain prevalent, and the flu pandemic of 1918 caught the world by surprise in a manner similar to COVID-19, leading to thousands of people dying and the widespread use of masks and social distancing. Public health institutions like the American Red Cross were in place to aid in these emergencies. But Black people did not receive the same level of care as white people from these types of establishment institutions. So, in 1920, Henrietta Vinton Davis, a UNIA member and follower of Marcus Garvey, founded the first chapter of the Black Cross Nurses in Philadelphia. Soon, Black Cross Nurse chapters popped up in conjunction with the UNIA all over North and Central America and the Caribbean. As Claiborne Benson, historian and executive director of the Wisconsin Black Historical Society, explains, the Black Cross Nurses took Garvey's Do for Self idea and applied it to public health. They performed regular home and hospital visits, administered needed medicine, and cared for pregnant women and new mothers who were ignored by establishment health institutions.
The Black Cross Nurses served that purpose by going to their homes, by treating them in their beds and caring for the issues that existed inside their house that makes their wellness becoming reality through clean house and through dishwashers and children and But they did even more than that. Many of them delivered babies, and they brought medicines from the drugstore to solve people's problems. They did all sorts of things because they actually cared about the people themselves. They saw it as being part of the Marcus Garvey movement, number one, and number two, helping to solve the problems of our people, and that being health issues, tuberculosis, when others did not want to or were reluctant to treat our people.
Milwaukee would get its chapter of the Black Cross Nurses in 1921, when Hattie Fountain, a member of Milwaukee's UNIA chapter, started organizing volunteers to start a chapter here. Not only did Hattie start the chapter, but she kept detailed notes of the nurses' activities here in Milwaukee, which provide the basis for the exhibit. In her diary, Hattie describes making house calls, seeing people in her home, and traveling to hospitals to visit people sick with various ailments. She also documents going to the train station to give smallpox inoculations, how the Black Cross nurses perform services similar to birth doulas, who would guide people through caring for themselves during pregnancy, as well as organize mutual aid for new mothers. The diary also described day-to-day life working for the UNIA, from cataloging membership certificates and meeting notes to stories of police raids in her home. As Wisconsin Black Historical Society Program Director Jamila Benson explains, this type of day-to-day documentation of Black Cross nurse activities in the 1920s is rare anywhere, despite the organization having chapters in dozens of countries.
It's really exciting. There are historians who are going to find out that this is actually written and want to know more about it. I want to read what she wrote. Because in my studies and in my research about Black Cross nurses, there's very little. There's information on Lady Davis, who started the Black Cross nurses, but to talk about an individual nurse and her day-to-day activity is really rare.
The Black Cross nurses continued this work in Milwaukee until the early 1950s, when Wisconsin Senator Joseph McCarthy started fueling anti-communist suspicions nationwide. Here he is making a speech in Rhinelander, Wisconsin, using, quote, lumberjack tactics to hack away at alleged communist activity.
As long as I am in the Senate, this task is not going to become a dainty task. If anyone wants to come in and remove them in some dainty fashion, they're welcome to it. But in the absence of that, if lumberjack tactics are the only kind of tactics that crowd understands, and take my word for it, those are the kind of tactics we're going to use on them, as long as there is one there endangering the lives of 150 million American people.
Now, McCarthy tended to focus his tirades in the early 1950s on supposed communist infiltration of U.S. government agencies and the military, not in the UNIA or Black Cross nurses specifically. However, over the years, his continued rhetoric fueled suspicion of these secret communist agents lurking everywhere, and Claiborne said that this caused the Black Cross nurses to fade away in Milwaukee because they feared becoming political prisoners.
There were Black Cross nurses all the way through the 1950s, and it's the McCarthy era that brings the fear in people, and they stop attending meetings. And I can't tell you that they were Black Cross nurses during that period of time, but they were members of the Marcus Garvey movement, and they stayed true to Marcus Garvey. How could you not when you get slogans like, up you mighty race, be strong, take care of yourself, do for self. These are words of significance to African Americans, and they respected and appreciated them, but they did not want to go to jail. Because the FBI and other government agencies would press people with, what are you doing? What are you guys saying in this meeting? That kind of thing. And that's the one thing that stopped the movement. Now, that's in the early 1950s, early 1950s. But throughout the 30s and the 40s, the Marcus Garvey movement is still alive.
But if you ask Vanessa Johnson, who we met at the beginning of the segment, about the impact of the Black Cross nurses, she'd say their lessons and their experience live on. Beginning from her birth, where her mother did not receive adequate health care, to her work now as a nurse and doula, Johnson saw herself in the exhibit. She saw herself in both the obstacles that she and the Black Cross nurses faced, and in the shared resolution to improve Black health outcomes.
Across the health sector, you know, the disparities are through the roof. And so, you know, it's important to know the history, to know about all of the pioneers who came before us so that we can continue to do this work, because it can weigh heavy on your heart, your spirit, on your mental health. But to know that we are, again, from the work that was done, that we have made strides, that we have made advances, but to know that there's still so much more to do. We have to keep pushing, and we have to keep fighting. And so that really drives me, where I think there's a quote that says, you know, like, we are our ancestors' wildest dreams, right? And so we can't give up. We have to keep going.
For Lake Effect, I'm Sam Woods.
Cause a sensation, independent, also liberal.
That was Wisconsin Black Historical Society's Claiborne and Jamila Benson. We also heard from Vanessa Johnson, a registered nurse and doula. Through her business, a miracle happened. That story was produced by Lake Effect Sam Woods last year. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, you can download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll bring WUWM's fourth and final roundtable discussion ahead of next month's presidential election. This one features the voices of young voters. That's tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect. On listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.